Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome to the program that helped you learn and improve your American English. We come to you 7 days a week with interesting stories from around the world, presented in a way that is easy to understand if English is not your first language. Today we have something special for you. You may remember that the Rana Plaza building in Bangladesh collapsed, killing 1,100 garment workers in April 2013. More than 2,500 other people were injured. Recently, the Victims' Compensation Fund finally reached its $30 million target. The needed amount came from a donor who asked to remain unidentified. All payments from the Rana Plaza Trust can now be made. As we hear from Katie Weaver, many victims desperately need the money as they continue to recover.
Rahana Akhtir is one such victim. She was working on the 7th floor of the Rana Plaza when she felt a strange sensation, like being in an elevator, she said. Then the 24-year-old woman heard a roaring sound. The room went dark. People started to run and scream. Ms. Akhtir fell, her leg twisted beneath a heavy column. She was rescued from the ruins almost 12 hours later. Ms. Akhtir's leg was crushed. 6 days later, doctors removed the leg from above the knee. The collapse of the 8-story Rana Plaza was the world's worst clothing factory disaster. The voluntary Rana Plaza Trust Fund includes donations from international clothing companies, the Bangladeshi government, and others. The International Labor Organization, or ILO, established the fund last year to compensate survivors and families of those who died. The Compensation Committee gave an update in April on the second anniversary of the collapse. At that point, more than $27 million had been raised. About 70% of the compensation had been paid to about 2,800 people. The payments range in size from about $625 and 9 months of salary for those without injuries to thousands of dollars for other victims. The top official of the Rana Plaza Claims Administration says some people received more than $31,000. The advocacy group Clean Clothes Campaign said only half of the clothing companies connected to Rana Plaza gave to the fund. Those donors include Mango, Primark, Walmart, C&A, and Inditex, owner of Zara. In April, the clothing business Benetton announced a contribution of $1.1 million to the fund. Clean Clothes Campaign had urged Benetton for months to contribute at least $5 million. Clean Clothes Campaign said last week, "This is a huge victory, but it's been too long in the making." The group said the companies involved make a total profit of more than $20 billion each year. Yet, it said, it took 2 years and intense public pressure to get them to provide $30 million. Clean Clothes Campaign said the lack of speedy action shows that voluntary social responsibility is not dependable. More than 2 years later, many survivors are still struggling. Money alone is often not enough. For example, some female garment workers say their husbands took their compensation payments and left the marriage. Others still experience mental problems or physical pain that makes it difficult to work. Rahana Akhtir received treatment from the Center for the Rehabilitation of the Paralyzed, a hospital in Dhaka near Rana Plaza. Last year, she began walking with a prosthetic leg made at the center. The group also gave her a cow and training as a way to make money. The prosthesis causes pain to her leg, and she uses a stick to help her walk. She has trouble pumping water and carrying things. She says she has a lot of difficulties, but still has to try to do something. This is life, she says. You have to move forward. Some of the neediest survivors received additional help from organizations including the International Labor Organization and local and international nonprofit groups. They supply training for new jobs or provide money to start small businesses. 35-year-old Litan Mia was a supervisor on the fourth floor of the Rana Plaza. He was trapped under the ruins for 14 hours. A university student rescued him. Mr. Mia's leg was fractured, and he could not work for 7 months. He says he was under serious stress about how to support his family. Mr. Mia received about $1,200 in compensation and attended a skills training workshop funded by the German aid agency GIZ. He says he used to remember the traumatic memory of the collapse, but after being involved in this business, he is always busy and does not have time to think about what happened. On a quiet street a few miles from Rana Plaza, Shahjahan Salim works in his small shop. The 37-year-old cannot use his hand very well, so sometimes customers get their own change from a plastic box on the counter. Mr. Salim was a supervisor on the fifth floor of the Rana Plaza. He was uninjured in the collapse, but he went back into the wreckage when he heard calls for help. Over 4 days, Mr. Salim rescued 37 people and recovered 28 bodies. On the fourth day, he freed a man by using a saw to cut off an arm trapped under heavy wreckage. Mr. Salim then slipped and fell 4 floors, more than 12 meters. He seriously injured his back. He was hospitalized and then treated at the Center for the Rehabilitation of the Paralyzed for almost a year. Today, it is very difficult for Mr. Salim to walk. With training and money from ActionAid and the ILO, Mr. Salim opened the shop where he works 7 days a week. As many as 200 customers come each day. The store helped him to go ahead, he says. Shahjahan Salim says he does not regret going back into the wreckage of Rana Plaza, although it left him permanently disabled. But, he says, the disaster should never have happened. Government should not permit this type of building, he says. We lost many lives. I want to see a garment industry where workers are safe. Widespread safety efforts are going on now in Bangladesh. At the same time, survivors of Rana Plaza struggle and carry on with their lives. I'm Katie Weaver.
You are listening to The Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Researchers say an experimental vaccine has shown to be highly effective at preventing the deadly disease Ebola. The World Health Organization said Friday that the vaccine has been 100% effective at tests performed in Guinea. The British medical journal Lancet has published early test results and analyses of the findings. Norway's foreign minister praised the effectiveness of the new vaccine, calling it the silver bullet against Ebola. Norway is one of the several countries involved in the testing. Ebola spread through West Africa last year. The disease killed more than 11,000 people, most of them in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. Ebola is one of a number of highly dangerous viruses known as hemorrhagic fevers. They can affect many organs, damage blood vessels, and affect the body's ability to fight infection. There are hopes the new vaccine may be a success in fighting against all such diseases. The vaccine is known as VSV-EBOC. Beginning in March, it was tested on more than 4,000 people in Guinea. All of them had come into close contact with the Ebola virus. WHO officials say early results were so promising that random tests were stopped this week, so everyone at risk could receive the vaccine immediately. The WHO's general director, Margaret Chan, spoke to reporters in Geneva. She said that scientists, doctors, and drug companies worked together in development of the vaccine. If proven effective, she said, the vaccine is going to be a game changer. She said it will affect efforts to control the current Ebola outbreak and future outbreaks. Researchers decided to change their efforts against the disease as the testing began. One reason was a sharp drop in the number of new cases in Africa over the past few months. The other was the changing nature of the Ebola epidemic. Last year, the disease spread very quickly over large parts of West Africa. But then it seemed to change, resulting in a series of sudden, small outbreaks across the area. The ideal way for testing a new drug would be to vaccinate half of a population at risk of contracting Ebola. At the same time, other people in the virus area would receive a placebo, or harmless substance. Instead, the team working on the vaccine chose to use a ring design. When a first Ebola case was reported in a village, researchers vaccinated everyone in contact with the sick person. Such rings of vaccination took place either immediately after an Ebola infection was confirmed or 3 weeks later. Of the 2,014 people vaccinated immediately, no one had Ebola when tested 10 days after receiving the new drug. A total of 2,380 people were vaccinated 3 weeks later. Only 16 of them became infected with the virus. I'm Anna Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, this is The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we tell about the conflicts among the nations in Europe during the 18th century and how they affected North America. During the 18th century, Spain, France, and Britain controlled land in North America. Spain controlled Florida. France was powerful in the northern and central areas. Britain controlled the east. All three nations knew they could not exist together peacefully in North America. The situation could only be settled by war. The powerful European nations already were fighting each other for control of territory and riches all over the world. These small wars continued for more than 100 years. They were called King William's War, Queen Anne's War, King George's War, and the French and Indian War. The French and Indian War was fought to decide whether Britain or France would be the major power in North America. France, its colonists, and their Indian allies fought against Britain, its colonists, and their Indian allies. The war began with conflicts over land. French explorers had been the first Europeans in the areas around the Great Lakes and the Ohio and Mississippi rivers. France had sent traders and trappers to these territories and had established trading centers there. Britain claimed the same land. When the king gave land in North America to someone, the land was considered to extend from the east coast to the west coast, although no one knew where the west coast was. The land along the east coast had become crowded, and settlers were moving west. White people were destroying the Indians' hunting areas. And Indians became worried that they would lose the use of their land. The Indian tribes might have been able to resist the people moving west if they had been united, but their own conflicts kept the tribes apart. When Britain and France started fighting each other, some Indians helped the British, others helped the French. The French settlers lived mainly in what was called New France. Today, it is part of Canada. Life there was different from life in the British colonies to the south. For example, there was no religious freedom. All settlers in French territories had to be French and belong to the Roman Catholic Church. So many French people who belonged to Protestant groups settled in the British colonies. These French Protestants were known as Huguenots. France also did not like the fact that the British paid the Indians high prices for animal furs. France was more interested in the fur trade than in settling the land. The British hurt the French traders' business when they bought fur from the Indians. One of the French trading centers was built in the area where the city of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania is today. The French called it Fort Duquesne. The British claimed it was in Virginia, and therefore that the land belonged to them. In 1754, the governor of Virginia sent a 21-year-old colonist named George Washington to tell the French to get out. This was the same George Washington who would later become the first president of the United States. The French refused to leave Fort Duquesne, so Washington and 150 men attempted to force them out. They attacked a group of Frenchmen and killed 10 of them. The French and Indian War had begun. British troops under the command of General Edward Braddock joined George Washington at Fort Duquesne. The British general expected to fight the way battles were fought in Europe. There, troops lined up on open fields and fired their weapons as they marched toward each other.
Fire!
The French and Indians did not fight this way. They hid in the woods. They wore clothing that made them difficult to see. They shot at the British from behind trees. The British had more troops than the other side, but the French and Indians won the Battle of Fort Duquesne. General Braddock was killed. Most of the French and Indian War was fought along two lakes in an area of what is now New York State, near the border with Canada. One was Lake George, the other Lake Champlain, north of Lake George. It reaches almost all the way to the city of Montreal in Canada. These lakes provided the best way to move troops and supplies during the French and Indian War. Few roads existed in North America at that time. The military force, which controlled the lakes and rivers, controlled much of North America. The French had military bases in the cities of Quebec and Montreal. The British had bases along New York's Hudson River. The area between them became the great battleground. Fighting increased after the British defeated the French near Lake George in the final months of 1755. The French then built a new base to control Lake Champlain and the surrounding area. The French base was at the southern end of Lake Champlain. They built a strong camp or fort. They called it Fort Carillon. The fort would control Lake Champlain and the area needed to reach the northern part of Lake George. The fort was designed to provide a strong defense against attack. The French built two big walls of logs several meters apart. The area between the walls was filled with dirt. Later, a strong stone front was added. Troops inside the walls were well protected. The British built a similar fort at the southern end of Lake George. They called it Fort William Henry. France sent one of its best military commanders to take command of its troops in America. His name was the Marquis de Montcalm. General Montcalm attacked several British forts in 1757. One of these was Fort William Henry on Lake George. The British commander was forced to surrender. General Montcalm promised that the British troops would be treated fairly if they surrendered. But the Indian allies of the French did not honor the surrender agreement. They began to kill British soldiers and settlers. No one is sure how many people died. It could have been more than 1,000. In 1758, a strong British force attacked Fort Carillon on Lake Champlain. General Montcalm was the French commander. Fort Carillon was strong enough that the smaller French force was able to defeat the larger British force. The British withdrew, but attacked again the next year. This time, the British commander was General Geoffrey Amherst. Amherst was successful. The British defeated the French. They changed the name of Fort Carillon to Fort Ticonderoga. It became an important military center in the French and Indian War. Fort Ticonderoga would also become important later during America's War for Independence. The Battle for Quebec was the turning point in the conflict. Britain and France signed a treaty to end the war in 1763. The British had won. They took control of the lands that had been claimed by France. Britain now claimed all the land from the east coast of North America to the Mississippi River. Everything west of that river belonged to Spain. France gave all its western lands to Spain to keep the British out. Indians still controlled most of the western territory, except for some Spanish colonies in Texas and New Mexico. Today, you can still visit the two forts that were so important in the French and Indian War. Not much remains of the original buildings. However, both have been rebuilt using the original designs. The area surrounding both forts is very beautiful, including the two lakes, Lake George and Lake Champlain. Many people travel to this area to enjoy the outdoors. The area includes one of America's National Historical Parks, Saratoga. It also includes the Lake George Beach State Park. Few people who visit this calm and peaceful area stop to remember the terrible fighting that took place there 250 years ago. The events following the French and Indian Wars will be our story next week. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.